Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 3:02 p.m. on Monday, March 26, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Eileen from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Ledoux, my Vice Chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business at this afternoon's meeting is Senate Bill 148, Background Checks for Police and Training, sponsored by the House. It's House Bill 148. It is Senate Bill. Sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. To provide a brief recap of the last meeting, on Wednesday, committee members reviewed the bill. The committee opened and closed the public hearing. My office did not receive any amendments to Senate Bill 148, so at this time I would like to move on to the final questions and discussion. First, does anyone on the committee have any questions about the bill? Hearing, Representative Eastman.
Mr. Chairman, my question is to the sponsor, if there's a sponsor's representative available.
Well, actually, it would be the, it's not the sponsor, but the his name I just blanked because I don't have my, what's that? Bob Griffiths is the best person to answer the question. Mr. Griffiths.
Through the chair, my question is to the section 19 on page 2. And I'm just wondering, why has this never been the case before now, or unless I'm missing something?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, could you refresh my memory about what particular section
you're says? Talking not about section 19 but subsection 19 of the amended statute.
What we're doing is we're adding here the admittance to a police training program, and this is something that, you know, may happen. There's not a requirement that it necessarily does happen, but this is information being submitted to the FBI, and I'm just wondering, you know, why hasn't this been an issue before now, or if it was, how has it been handled in the past?
In the past, Representative Eastman, through
please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Bob Griffiths. I'm the Executive Director for Alaska Police Standards Council. So the question is, why has this not been an issue before? And the answer is fairly simple. Prior to last year, we were deemed a law enforcement agency. So under that authority, we routinely ran fingerprints as a law enforcement agency. 2 years ago, unbeknownst to us, the FBI reclassified us to a licensing agency, and we lost that authority that gave us access to the fingerprint-based background checks. So to gain it back, we're putting it onto this list, or we're asking the legislature to put it on this list for occupational licenses.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, any final comments from committee members about the bill? Hearing and seeing none, Representative Christ Tompkins, may I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move 30-GS2594/A of SB 148 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, Senate Bill 148 moves from committee. I would ask everyone to stay afterwards to sign the paperwork. We will at this time adjourn this meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for this evening, tonight, at March 26th at 7 p.m. Our office is just making a final review of the committee substitute for House Bill 75. As soon as we've finished that review, and I know there's at least one change that we had in the committee substitute, we will be distributing the CS to the committee by email as soon as we can. It will be my goal this evening, and I'd recognize that Representative Stutz has joined us. It was going to be my goal this evening to review the CS, adopt it as our committee substitute, and then hear public testimony on the committee substitute to House Bill 75. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 3:06 p.m.
Okay. Okay.
Hey, Madison, you got me here on the testifier?
Yeah, that sounds good.
And what about this mic right here?
That one sounds good.
And this mic right here?
That one sounds good.
And this mic right here?
That one sounds good.
And the chair's mic right here?
That's good.
And this mic right here?
That one sounds good.
And what about this mic right here?
That one's good as well.
And the final mic, how's this one sound?
All good.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yep, have a good meeting.
Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 7 p.m. on Monday, March 26, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings. And we've got a new guy whose name I don't know. Max. You have been here before, and I apologize. From the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound, at this time I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today we have Representative Kopp, Representative Stutz, my vice chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business this evening is House Bill 75, Gun Violence Protective Orders, sponsored by Representative Tarr. This is the sixth hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. The committee should have received by email today the new work draft of House Bill 75, version U, by email. And at this time, I'd like to review the work draft. And for those purposes, I'm actually going to, since my office has been working extensively on this, I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Christ Tompkins so that I can present the CS. I recognize that Representative Eastman has joined us. Oh, it is not version U, it's version R. And I will, do you want me to stay here or do you want me to go to the other seat or does it matter? All right, I'm going to stay here. By order of the people on either side of me. Version R of CS for House Bill 75. Section 1 makes violating a gun violence protective order as described in Section 7 a Class A misdemeanor. What's that? We were going to adopt it after I did that. That's okay. Section 7, AS 1156-740C, adds the definition of a gun violence protective order created in Section 7 to the list of definitions in Alaska Criminal Code. Section 3 adds a new section to AS 1235, allowing for the warrantless seizure of a firearm from an individual believed to be dangerous, with reference to the procedures in AS 1865-815 through 1865-845 in the event of such a seizure. Section 4 allows a peace officer to arrest a person with or without a warrant who violates a gun violence protective order. Section 5 adds a conforming amendment to the existing powers of the Department of Public Safety to add this to their existing central registry for a gun violence protective order. The registry must include for each protective order the names of the petitioner and respondent, their dates of birth, and the conditions and duration of the order. The Department of Public Safety shall retain a record of the protective order after it has expired. Section 6 adds a conforming amendment to the existing powers of the Department of Public Safety to take reasonable steps to report that the order, modified order, or dismissal is entered into the central registry within 24 hours after being received. Section 7 amends AS 1865 to add seven new sections. The likely use of a gun violence protective order would, it is expected in almost all situations, would start with an ex parte order under Section 1865-820. So if you're looking at the R version, you would want to go to the next page and look at 1865-820, which allows a peace officer to request an ex parte gun violence protective order. If the court finds that the petition establishes probable cause to believe that the individual is a dangerous individual, the court shall ex parte and without notice to the respondent issue a gun violence protective order, and it defines how the order would be created. Following the ex parte order and service of the order, a contested or 20-day hearing would occur, and that's what is in 1865-815, which would be on the prior page. In gun violence protective orders, it allows a peace officer to file a petition for a protective order against a respondent if they reasonably believe that the respondent is a dangerous individual. When a petition for a protective order is filed, the court shall schedule a hearing and provide at least 10 days' notice to the respondent of the hearing. The notice of the hearing must inform the respondent of the option to waive the hearing. The notice must inform the respondent that if the respondent does not appear at the hearing, the respondent will have 6 months to request a hearing regarding the protective order. A protective order issued under this section expires 6 months after it is issued unless dissolved earlier by the court at the request of either the peace officer or the respondent after notice, and if requested, a hearing. A protective order issued under this section shall prohibit the respondent from possessing, owning, possessing, receiving, or attempting to purchase or receive a gun or ammunition. If the court issues a protective order under this section, the court shall direct the respondent to surrender to the appropriate law enforcement agency, sell to a firearms dealer, or deliver to a court-approved third party all firearms and ammunition that the respondent possesses or owns within 48 hours after receipt of the order. Section 1865-825 addresses modification of a gun violence protective order, and it allows the peace officer or the respondent to request modification of the gun violence protective order, and it describes how to modify the order. Section 1865-830, surrender of firearms and ammunition. It allows the court to order the respondent to temporarily surrender or sell all firearms and ammunition within 48 hours of receipt of the protective order. When the protective order is terminated or expires, the law enforcement agency shall notify the respondent that the return of the firearm or ammunition to the respondent is available. Section 1865-835 addresses service of process and forms for petition orders, fees, warnings, notification, and pending civil or criminal actions. And this requires the Alaska court system to prepare forms to file this protective order without changing filing fees, and establishes that violating the protective order is a misdemeanor punishable by up to 1 year incarceration and a fine of $25,000, and clarifies that the respondent is not entitled to a court-appointed counsel employed at the public's expense to contest the order. And I would go back briefly to Section 830, and I just would note that under Section 830, there's a 48-hour, if it is a contested hearing for what I call the 20-day order, the respondent would have 48 hours to turn in their guns if so ordered. But if it is done ex parte, there would not be any warning required, because if the officer has seized the guns, then the protective order, they would have already seized the guns and there would not be any notice to turn them in. Going on to Section 1865-840, notification of law enforcement agencies, requires the court to notify local law enforcement of the order so it can be enforced. Section 1865-845 defines a dangerous individual for purposes of filing a gun violence protective order. And then in Section 8, AS 2215-100, adds a conforming amendment to the existing powers of district court judges and magistrates to be able to administer this new gun violence emergency protective order. Section 9 amends AS 2235030 to add a new subsection B, stating that the Alaska court system may not publish a court record of an ex parte protective order on a publicly available website, which means that the ex parte orders that are not contested would not go on court view, but the contested hearings would show up if a person was found at that hearing to be dangerous. Section 10, indirect court rules amendments, lists court rules that are affected by the bill relating to court fees and the process for issuing protective orders. And Section 11, conditional effects, Sections 1 through 9 of this legislation only take effect if Section 10 gets a two-thirds majority vote of each house of the Alaska legislature, which is required by Article 4, Section 15 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And Section 12 provides for an effective date of October 1st, 2018, and that effective date was at the request of the court system that wanted the additional time to prepare the forms that would be needed to comply with this particular law should it pass. And that is a summary of the R version. I would note that the three biggest changes from the original version of House Bill 75 to the R version of House Bill 75 is that in the original version, individuals, basically non-police officers, could apply for a gun violence protective order, With this change, the only people that could apply for the order would be police officers. Of course, the public could go to the police and ask for the police to apply for such an order, but the public wouldn't have a right to apply on their own. The second change is that in the original proposal, it would prohibit ownership of weapons, and the bill has been modified so that it only prohibits possession and purchasing, but it would not prohibit somebody from owning the weapons. Essentially, a situation if one has got weapons seized, we don't want to get in the process of prohibiting somebody from owning something, because when the order expires, they would, in theory, would still own those same guns. And the third change from the original bill is it specifically allows a police officer, if he encounters an individual they believe to be dangerous and in possession of a gun, to be able to seize that without a warrant, but then they would immediately, or within 72 hours after seizing that weapon, they would have to file one of the gun violence protective orders that explains why they seized them and the reasons for that, and submit that to the court for the court to review. So that's a summary of the bill, and I think, Mr. Chair, our goal was to move quickly to public hearing and then go to questions after the public hearing.
Thank you, Representative Clayman. With the CS presented, should we entertain a motion to adopt it or proceed with public testimony?
I think we can move to adopt the public or the
Clayman,
CS.
Can you just notify that we've been here since Section 5, us two?
Oh.
Sorry, come again, Representative Reinbold?
Oh, I just wanted to make sure that you recognize that we've been here since Section 5, about 4 after 7.
Yes, thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Ledoux has joined us for 4 after 7 o'clock. Is there a motion, yes, to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chair, I would move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 75 version 30-LS0304/R as our working document.
I object.
Representative Eastman, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, I appreciate the chairman's quick summary, but with the bill as long as this is, more than 10 pages, I need a little bit more time to look at it before we start timelines on amendments and everything else that goes along with adopting a CS.
Noted. Is there further committee discussion on the adoption of the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I would just note that looking at what the state of Indiana has with respect to gun violence protective orders, I believe their law. I have the 2012 Indiana Code. I think it may have been adopted quite a bit before that. But this is very, very similar. I know that that has withstood court scrutiny. And I believe from reviewing what was emailed out to us, this has considerably more due process protection. So I'm favorable to this. In other words, I think this is a much better starting point than we were at before, and I appreciate the work of the chair bringing this before us.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Further comment from the committee on the motion to adopt the CS? Representative Reinbold?
Can I just ask a question? Basically, I got this like less than an hour ago, or right about an hour ago. I just don't know when it was actually ready, but I sure would have liked more time to look at it before committee.
Noted, Representative Reinbold.
I thought it was ready last week.
I'm not knowing when it was or was not ready. I do have an understanding that we'll be working with the CS for a while going forward. So, but your comments appreciated. Representative Ledoux.
I sure like this version better than the old version.
Succinct as usual, Representative Ledoux. Representative Stutes, any comment?
Well, except that I really appreciate the work that went into it, because I had an opportunity to get my two cents in, and I see that it's been tailored really, really nicely. I think that I'm really happy with this version. Thank you.
I didn't even have to get the stopwatch going, as the chair normally does. Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Would the clerk please call the roll on the motion to adopt the CS?
Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Stutes?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Yes.
Sorry. Representative Eastman?
No.
Yay. Chair Clayman?
Yes.
Okay. That is 6 yeas, 1 nay.
And by a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay, the motion to adopt draft 30-LS0304/R as the committee substitute and working document carries. And with that, I will pass the gavel back to Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins. So what we're going to do now is open the public hearing, and then we'll get to questions. And so I will open public testimony in House Bill 75. And I'd note that if you are on the phone, although we're going to take folks in the room first, make sure you're not on a speakerphone. First, is there anyone here in the room that would like to testify? Please come forward. Please state your name for the record. It's our habit to give you 2 minutes for public comment.
All right. Good evening, members of the committee. My name is Stella Tallman, and I'm a sophomore at Juno Douglas High School. I'm strongly in favor of House Bill 75 because it's a huge step in the right direction to ensuring a safe future for students and citizens like me. I'd also like to thank Representative Tarr for bringing this legislation forward. Recently, my peers across the country have been speaking out about the need for more gun control in our nation. Through the National Student Walkout and the March for Our Lives, we have shown you that we are sick and tired of being scared to go to school because school shootings and regular lockdown drills have become the norm for us. We could provide as many mental health programs as we wanted and put metal detectors in every school, but it wouldn't solve the problem because it's guns that do the killing in the end. Our current gun laws do not ensure domestic tranquility. They do not provide for the common defense. They do not promote the general welfare. And most of all, they do not ensure the blessings of liberty, particularly liberty to receive a quality public education and not get shot during it to ourselves and our posterity. I know I speak for thousands of my peers across the state when I say that enough is enough. It's time to pass common sense gun laws in Alaska. So please, do the right thing and for our future and vote yes on HB 75, because we're saying never again, and we really mean it this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you state your name again?
My name is Stella Tallman. Okay.
I have a question.
Representative Reinbold, do you have a question?
Couple questions. First of all, you said you represent a lot of kids. Do you have like a resolution? Is this from your classmates? Is this something you worked on in school?
Actually, yes. I'm on student council at my school, and we organized our national student walkout a couple weeks ago. And I know, and there were hundreds of kids that attended, and we had community support. And I've talked to many of my peers, and they say they support gun control in our nation and in our state.
And
I can't give you an exact number though.
Okay. Can I continue?
Follow up.
Okay, so are the teachers involved in this? And also, if you could answer, how many school shootings have there been in Alaska? Because you said it's on a regular basis.
Through the chair. The teachers are not involved in this. It's the students that are coming together. And I can't give you an exact number of school shootings in Alaska. I know there was one in Bethel. I can't remember exactly when, but it was a little while back. And just in our nation, there are, I think, school shootings every week, and that just devastates me as a student. So,
through the chair.
Representative Reinbold, follow-up.
So I believe, to the best of my knowledge, there was one in Bethel, and I believe it was 21 years ago. Do you recall any other ones in the state?
Through the chair, no, I don't, but I believe that Alaska should play its part as a state in the United States to promote gun control, because this is what I know a lot of my peers believe is right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Noah Adams.
Williams.
I'm sorry, Williams. I apologize. It is Williams on the Rogers roster, and I just misread. And even though I said your name, Mr. Williams, you should state it before you start talking.
Of course. Thank you. My name is Noah Williams, for the record. I'm here representing myself. I'm here today to represent a very overlooked angle of this issue, and that is gun suicides. This bill, we get a lot of focus on the gun violence against others aspect of the issue of gun violence, but the majority of shootings are the majority of gun deaths, I should say, in this country are actually self-inflicted. And this bill would not just allow for people who believe would not just allow for the confiscations of people's guns who are a threat to others, but also to themselves. And that I believe that will save a lot of lives that we don't see. It's difficult to collect statistics on the lives that you save from measures like this. But I can guarantee you a lot of students are on, have been set on edge by the events of the last year, and I'm one of them, actually. I was very close and in a state of despair, and if I had had a gun, access to a gun, I probably wouldn't be standing in front of you today. I probably would have taken my own life. So in any case, thank you for coming forward with this legislation, and no Williams in support.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Please come forward. I don't have you on the list, but I will. You can tell us who you are.
Hello, my name is Carrie Willoughby. I have lived in Alaska for 15 years. My profession is I'm a financial planner, and I'm also a mom. I guess I'm here representing myself and other mothers. I have a six-year-old son, Paxton Willoughby. He's in school here in Juneau at Harborview, and I'm simply one of the millions of Americans who know that thoughts and prayers are not enough, and that as lawmakers, we are counting on you to make the needed changes to protect our children in school from violence. So I just wanted to come here tonight to urge you to please support Representative Tarr's bill. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the room that would like to please come forward? I'd also note that Nancy Mead from the court system is here. She's not asking to testify, but after we get done with testimony, if you have questions, she's available. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Holly Handler. I'm a resident of Juneau, Alaska, and I'm here to testify on behalf of myself and my family. I'm the mother of twin boys who are 9 years old, and as a mom of kids in school, I can tell you that active shooter drills are a regular part of our family conversation and a part of parent-teacher conferences. And as a constituent, I'm not here to ask you to fix gun violence all in one day or in one session, but I do hope that you will consider House Bill 75 as one step towards making our community safer and making our schools safer. I'm also an attorney, and one of the things I do as an attorney is I represent women in domestic violence protection hearings. And I can tell you that one of the scariest things, one of the scariest conversations I have to have with clients is that after they get a protective order, which is a piece of paper, talking about doing safety planning because an enraged boyfriend, ex-partner, spouse may react to the protective order by coming to their home with a gun. And oftentimes the protection orders themselves don't include provisions like these, which call for forfeiture of weapons. And I've had clients who are terrified every night after they get a protective order that despite this piece of paper in their hand, they are terrified of their former partner coming in and shooting them. Because it doesn't have to happen in our community to be afraid of it. It doesn't have to happen down the street of us, down the street to be afraid of things like this. We know that it happens in our country, and we know that one of the problems is insufficient protections in place. So as a mom and as a concerned citizen, I'd ask for you to support House Bill 75. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the room that would like to testify? All right, we'll turn to those online. The first, we've got Jasmine
Aramia.
Aramia. Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins from Petersburg. Ms. Aramia.
Hi. My name is Jasmine Aramia. I'm a 17-year-old high school senior at Petersburg High School. Thank you for hearing me today. I'm calling in support of House Bill 75. I believe that House Bill 75 is a step in the right direction concerning gun control safety laws in Alaska. And although this bill is not it, I would like to see a bill directly concerning mental health issues within the state, such as helping aid and diagnose those with severe mental illnesses. Throughout the years, many children have been subject to mass murders at the hands of both unchecked rage and aggression, not to mention that Alaska has the highest rate of suicide per capita in the nation. I count myself very lucky to live in a state where mass shootings are not a norm, but I don't want to wait for the day that those shootings are. I believe that House Bill 75 could not only help lead Alaska but other states to a safer future. I urge legislators to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I've got Abby Hardy, also online. Ms. Hardy.
Good evening. My name is Abby Hardy. I'm 18 years old and a high school senior at Petersburg High School. I'm calling in support of House Bill 75 concerning gun control laws and extreme risk protection in Alaska. I believe House Bill 75 should be passed as a common sense measure of public safety, especially considering high suicide rates and domestic violence in our state. In view of recent and tragic school shooting cases in the U.S., the March for Our Lives, and student walkouts, I believe this bill would be a safeguard in ensuring the feeling of safety in schools. As a student, I've always felt safe in school with both my peers and teachers up until recent events in our nation. I feel that now changes should be made so that every other student should feel safer in years to come, also considering we do have regular lockdown drills because these cases of school shootings seem so regular now. And I believe that House Bill 75 will move forward in doing so. Concerning mental health, I believe House Bill 75 is a step forward in providing a more preventative measure in public safety and awareness of mental health and what should be considered extreme risks. I urge the legislators to pass the Bill of Public Safety, and as it does not infringe on Second Amendment rights and will be a step in the right direction for both students and the general public safety. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next person online, I have Joseph Schlanger calling from Wasilla. Mr. Schlanger.
Yes, I'm here. My name is Joseph Schlanger, and I'm from Wasilla, and I'm representing myself. Give you a little history lesson on the Alaska Constitution. I'm against this order. I believe that it needs to be fixed. I believe it does need to be some protection for the victim, and I do believe that's already in there with the protective order, because I do believe it does say that you can't possess a weapon if you have a protective order against you. But here, searches and seizures, Alaska Constitution, Section 14, Article 1, the right of the people to secure in their persons, houses and other property, papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And you've got in there that the peace officer can go in there and basically go in there with a warrant, without a warrant. And it says that under the warrantless search. So I was wondering if we could change that. Also, I believe it's a violation of Article 1, Section 19, the right to keep and bear arms. The individual has a right to keep and bear arms and shall not be denied or infringed by the state. You guys are instituting this law or this bill because you're overreacting about a school shooting. I realize that this happened, but the people that are on the side of the school shooting do not want to hear what the other side has to say. And we've seen this over and over in the mainstream media and with the state of Alaska. The governor has come out and said that he's with the students, he's with this. We're taking our guns. That's exactly what the students are talking about, is wanting to take our weapons from us to protect us. Because even
Mr. Schlanger, we have a two-minute limit on public testimony. I think you actually testified on the original version of the bill, and I appreciate that you took the time to study the our version that we're looking at tonight. I'll give you about 10 seconds to conclude. Did you want to conclude your remarks?
What's that?
I'll give you about 10 seconds to conclude your remarks.
I have nothing else.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't see anyone else online to provide public testimony. I'll make one more opportunity. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 75 that hasn't already testified? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing. And see if there's questions from the committee about the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
So a couple. They're more comments than questions. Should I hold that, Mr. Chair?
No, I think it's Representative Kupp. I know and Representative Reinbold, you asked earlier, the CS wasn't, we didn't get the final version of the CS till about 5 minutes to five this evening. So I think it was in your emails within 15 minutes of the time we received it. Questions or comments are both fine this evening.
So
it's after usual hours, and we'll be a little more informal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the concerns of the last gentleman that called. Any time we hear the terms gun control or other language that often means solely curtailing Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms, that frankly always greatly concerns me, too, as I strongly believe in our Second Amendment, and that it wasn't just given to provide for a military, but ultimately it was to protect the people from a tyrannical government if necessary. And it's one of the unique things about this country we live in is our right to keep and bear arms. And I do think it's a false dichotomy that this debate about gun violence often boils down between those who own guns and those who don't approve of them. I think that's a very superficial argument. And I just wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, that people who own guns deeply love and care about children. And that's often we hear a message that is not true. But I am not interested in limiting the freedoms of law-abiding, non-dangerous persons at all. I would note that in my 23 years serving in law enforcement in Alaska, I was enforcing the provisions of the domestic violence sexual assault protective orders, which are far more limiting than this, in that they actually forcibly remove you from your own home, forcibly remove your property and your vehicles, and if the court finds it, your firearms. And we've had those laws on the books for many decades because, frankly, we do that to keep people alive in volatile domestic violence situations. There is due process afforded in that people do have a right to appear in short order before the court, and the court determines if that order is going to be continued or if it will be discontinued. And I do like the fact that we are going towards a time-proven model of protecting folks from violence. Now, one of the unique things that's different about this is a crime does not necessarily need to have occurred. But what we're looking at, from my understanding, Mr. Chairman, is if someone posts several times on Facebook that they want to be a professional school shooter, but have not directly depicted a place, time, or a victim. It is hard for the protective order now to work because you can't particularly specify a victim that has been identified other than a person's mindset that they want to do that. So what the bill does in front of us is it allows in a situation where someone manifests either verbal language or behavior that they have an intent or that their behavior and the fact that they possess a firearm makes them very likely to inflict harm on themselves or others, as the bill says, that some action can be taken before tragedy strikes. And the due process is, if it's an ex parte, within 72 hours, a hearing is ordered, or if it's a six-month order, then it's within 10 days a person has to, they're notified, they have to respond to the court, and a hearing will be set within 10 days, and the judge will make a determination based on all the facts and circumstances. Sworn statements are required. They will be examined under the law like witnesses are now. And I think that this very closely mirrors a tool that we have now in the law that is actually much more restrictive. And I think as we go through this bill, we'll see that the court can, at any point, find the order meaningless. Even though now we've limited it to only police officers, the court can still reject it, just like they can reject an application for a search warrant or reject an application for an emergency domestic violence protective order filed by a police officer. They could certainly reject this on its face if they felt it did not rise to the level of meeting the dangerous person definition we have provided for in this. So for a number of reasons, I feel confident that there's not a single person at this table that wants to say when people make statements or post online that they intend to do something but have left one blank in the sentence, and that's who the victim is and when, that we want to just to stand by and wait for victims to stack up before we do anything. And I would just reiterate that from someone who is a fierce defender of our Second Amendment rights, I, as a parent of children that have gone through schools, want law enforcement to at least have the tools. And now we're speaking about law enforcement, Mr. Chairman. A previous version allowed any person. I think it allowed for a lot more possible abuse the committee was concerned about. But now it is public safety professionals who day in, day out are trained to look at evidence in the law, facts, what rises to probable cause and what doesn't. And the people who will be responding to these things, you have to convince them, then they have to convince the court. And I think that we're off to a good overview of a possible tool that we could implement that could leave us in a better position than we are now to not just protect our youth, but as the young man stated, if someone is known to be suicidal and has made those threats, talks of health of self-harm, would it be possible that a peace officer in those circumstances be able to get a protective order until that person's temporary storm in their life had passed? We know suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I think most of the school shooters were looking for a permanent solution to a temporary insanity they were experiencing in their life. So thank you for that liberty, Mr. Chairman. But again, I would just close by saying I'm pleased to see this closely mirror the domestic violence protective orders, which are far more liberty restricting in the law than this gun violence protective order is.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Representative Reinbold.
Okay,
you can have questions or comments.
Well, I've got a whole mix of both, so okay. I'm not sure how to proceed.
Well,
but
why don't you start with questions, and then I'll give you time for comments.
I think first of all, I think it's important that I believe nobody wants guns to get in the hands of the wrong individuals, period. I mean, especially dangerous people that have a possibility of hurting themselves or others. I mean, that's where I think we all agree. Where the concern is gun-free zones. I've heard most, if large majority of mass shootings have been in gun-free zones. So I think that's just something important to get on the record.
Representative Reinwald, this bill does not create any gun-free zones.
Well, I guess it's debatable if you confiscate guns away from a household or a business or something, then, I mean, technically it can create a gun-free zone.
This bill would only take guns away from an individual. So if two individuals lived in a house, and I think we heard that testimony earlier, if two individuals lived in a house and the order removed the guns from one, that wouldn't remove all guns from the house. Now, one might very well choose in that one's house, if there were guns in the house and you had a person that you wouldn't want to have guns, one might choose to not surrender your guns to the police but have somebody else keep that guns. But this order in and of itself would not create such a gun-free zone. It would just limit one person to prevent one person from having possessing them.
And thank you, Mr. We could go on and on and on about this. If only the one person owned the guns in the house and the house got robbed, you know, then that is a gun-free zone and they can't self-defend. So I wasn't planning on going down this rabbit hole with you.
Okay,
I was just trying to get on the record that some people could argue that we could be creating gun-free zones. And I just think that that's just you know, we also, it could be helping by taking the guns away.
And can you focus on the questions that you have, and then I'll give you some, like, I gave Representative Kopp fair flexibility to make comments, but let's get the questions first and then go
but
to
I
comments.
But I think it's important. I have four questions here, but I think it's very, very important to state, you know, that there are tens of millions of guns out there first. I think they're all out there.
Representative Reinbold, we're very aware, and then Alaska probably has the highest per capita gun possession of maybe not all states, but one of the highest gun possession per capita in the country. We know that.
Well, and before I wanted to ask my four questions, I want to state guns do nothing alone. They do not harm anybody. There is hundreds of thousands, I would guess, in the state of Alaska. They do nothing alone, just like a car does nothing alone, just like pills do nothing alone, just like knives do nothing alone. It is a heart, mind, soul, physical, mental breakdown that causes it. And that's why I want to get that on the record before I ask the questions. My questions are,
one at a time.
And I do believe that I see opportunities, especially with Senate Bill 91, where this may come in handy. So when I ask these questions, I'm asking, first of all, has a bill, I understand it's Indiana, is there any other bills, have they shown a dramatic reduction of suicides and murder, and have the cops done well with this? Does anybody know the answer to that question?
That's a question that the bill sponsor can probably answer. Sure.
Good. Good evening, Representative Garantar, for the record. Through the chair to Representative Reinbold, the Indiana law was passed in 2005. The Connecticut law was passed in 1999. So those are the two states where there's a number of years of information where you could actually make some of those calculations. In Connecticut, it has been proven to reduce the number of suicides, and they can link the number of guns taken, and I want to say it was for every 11 guns taken, they were able to prevent one death. They don't have information, and this came up in testimony. It's hard to extrapolate whether preventing that individual from hurting themselves also meant preventing them from hurting another person, because those two things happen frequently, especially in domestic kind of incidents where someone kills the family and then kills themselves. So we know for the individual. So in that case, it has been proven. And in Indiana, what's interesting is that there's also, and I think it's in the chart that we provided the committee, a high percentage of folks actually don't try to retrieve their firearms once the protective order is over and just choose then to let law enforcement have them. So that's a different sort of evidence, but I think shows that people have realized or chosen afterwards that it was okay that for that particular individual were no longer going to have possession of them, and that was the right thing for that individual. The other three states that have them are much more recent, and so they're in the information gathering phase. Washington passed it by citizen initiative in 2016, and then Oregon and California was 2015. And then Oregon was last year, and so there's not as robust of data for those locations.
So can I you've got with her? Well, is that who I ask the question to, or do I ask them to you?
Well, I don't know the question.
Okay.
We'll see who the best person answered.
So any official statistics is what I'd like to do, like if it's a uniform crime stats-based, you know, evidentiary, this is what I'd like to see. So that's really helpful. The next question that I have is what are the peace officers thinking about? Is this something that the APD wants to do? The state troopers are behind. Is this something, because I find it pretty intimidating to go with the search, you know, and no search warrant to go, you know, dig into people's stuff and take guns. I would think you're putting them in harm's way. So I don't know if they've had an opportunity to weigh in on this yet.
Through the chair to Representative Reinbold, we have worked with Department of Law, Department of Public Safety. I know there's been conversations with APD. I don't feel like I'm the best person to speak on their behalf. We have talked about what happens in an incident where they would go and whether, for example, it's reflected in the fiscal notes with the Department of Public Safety fiscal note being indeterminate because they don't know how frequently this tool would be used, and so they can't really predict how often they would need to go and retrieve firearms to secure them rather than the person voluntarily relinquishing them. And they have said that they would do that with two officers right? They're not going to send an individual on that call alone or to do that process alone. And so that's more the conversation we had, was more the sort of logistics and the staffing impact on that. But again, the reason it's indeterminate is until we have such a policy in place, it's hard to know if it would be used once a month or if it would be used once a week or once a year. And so I think if those folks are available, then they might be better able to just sort of flesh that out.
And they're not available tonight. I've also had some conversations with representatives from Anchorage Police, and one of the changes in the CS that we've now adopted that was requested in those conversations with APD, under the original version of the bill, if an ex parte order was issued, then the police would serve that on a person. And the typical procedure, as Representative Tarr stated, is that, similar to a domestic violence protective order, they send two officers to serve those, because you may remember several years ago there was a domestic violence protective order being served by one officer at a home in Eagle River, and they knocked on the door, and when the person came out, they came out with guns and killed the officer. And that led to Anchorage Police having a policy of always sending two officers. And the critique from the police was that if they served a gun violence protective order on day one, and then, sorry, it thinks I said something about Siri. If they served a protective order on day one, and the person said, I'm not turning over my guns, then the police would need to go get a warrant. And that situation, when you now go to take the guns from somebody who said they're not turning them over, doesn't become a two-officer situation. That becomes a full SWAT team coming with a search and seizure warrant to seize the guns. And so the request from APD was they if they were going to be serving these, they wanted the authority to take the weapons immediately when they served the order. And then if they didn't serve the order, that would be violating the gun violence protective order that would allow an arrest at that time. So that was tailoring those to make this proposal similar to a domestic violence protective order in terms of the procedure when an officer gets to the house and says, you have to do this, and if they decline, it gives the officer immediate authority to arrest for not following the order. But I will make efforts to get somebody from either APD or the troopers to provide further testimony, obviously not here tonight, but at the next hearing.
And speaking on that point, I think that we need more than just one, or someone that's able to speak on behalf of the troopers, on behalf of the Juneau Police Department, on behalf of the APD, not just one person coming with their personal or being told what to say by the mayor or the governor. So it just needs to be a fair, broad representation, I think, if we get, because I think, I mean,
we'll do our best.
Okay, and then if I have just a couple more.
Go ahead.
If we could go through on page 2, line 30, the warrantless search, that one definitely raised some concerns. How broad is that warrantless search?
Well, I think the first point is, if you look at subsection C, nothing in this section authorizes a peace officer to perform a warrantless search or seizure if a warrant would otherwise be required. So it's a very limited exception to the warrant requirement. And the main point is that they have to find that they're basically presented with an individual face-to-face that they believe is dangerous right there. And so the idea of, wait a minute, this person is waving a gun around in a bar, and now I need to go to court and get a warrant, get an order that allows me to seize the weapon when they're waving it around in the bar, is exactly the place we want an officer to be able to act without a warrant. And today, there's many situations an officer can act to seize a weapon without a warrant. And then the other, actually a very good example, we had distributed several days ago the Indiana case that describes the situation in Indiana in which there was a challenge to the warrantless arrest or the warrantless seizure of a weapon. And that's a situation where the person was in a parking garage and was watching a nightclub across the way, and it was apparently watching for somebody to come out. And again, the officers felt it was appropriate to seize the firearm without going to the court first. So it's a very limited circumstance. I know Representative Kopp, I've talked with him as well. He may be able to provide some further insight about police circumstances and when this might come to play.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think Representative Ryan Bold, I really like the concern for officer safety. I think it's great. And as far as the warrantless seizure of firearms, it's this basically puts into statute what has been done in practice for many decades. If you're observing a dangerous situation where someone is telling you that they want to kill their old lady, or they are wanting to blow their boss's head off, and you are right there with them, and they are in a rage, and you see that there's a handgun there on the counter, it would be beyond a poor judgment to leave that person and that firearm together at the same time. So you would take it for safekeeping, write your report, send it to the district attorney's office. Chances are that gun may be released back to the person the following day. But these types of situations police face frequently, where they're making judgment calls based on should that person and that firearm be still together after I'm no longer present. And a decision has to be made, and so that would be under this warrantless seizure.
Follow up, Representative Ryan.
Okay, so I guess basically I probably didn't word the question like I probably should have. In Section 3, what does this bill allow that was not allowed before?
Representative, I actually think that what this bill does is it allows the officers to do what they're already doing, but it actually provides a process and procedure that wasn't required before, which now, in the circumstances like Representative Cobb has described, the officer having seized the weapon would actually need to go down to court and file the request for gun violence protective order, so there would actually be a crime hasn't been committed, but they seize the weapon, they go and file the paperwork, so there's actually a record of why they did it and how, and then the judge would have to take a look at that to confirm. Representative Cobb?
So, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I like about this is that it puts a time limit of 72 hours, so the gun just can't be sitting in safekeeping for 2 weeks because you don't like the person, or the officer may be guessing the person may continue to be dangerous, but within 72 hours, the gun violence protective order petition must be filed with the court, and the court then will have to move to rule on that. So protections for gun owners are in place, and that there's hard timelines built into this versus just the judgment of the police or the DA on how long they would like to see the gun in safekeeping. So this actually puts a process, kind of like I said in my opening remarks, there's more due process built into this that ensure that the rights are protected on either end.
Paula?
Well, actually, this is just kind of, I'm just going to wrap this up. But so basically, just to summarize what I'm looking, and I haven't actually had a chance to read
that's your last, you don't have any more questions?
The whole bill, not questions, but okay. I just wanted to
but
say.
But you're done with your questions?
Yes.
Okay.
But
good.
Yes, so thank can
you.
I make the.
Absolutely, go ahead and make comments.
Right. So basically, I just was going to wrap up what I was asking for is one, where has this been proven to reduce crime? Because all of us want to reduce crime. If this is helping and there's evidence, and I want, like FBI crime statistics or something similar, the liability of the state is something I would really like to talk, if we are creating any liabilities when people are not able to self-defend, if we are creating gun-free zones. Also, like I've stated, both on the state level, maybe the federal level, and on the local level, on a broad sense, what the officers, because I think this is their job, and I really, really want to get their input in regards to this. And last, fiscal notes. I would love to see what kind of fiscal notes this bill has. I haven't seen any yet.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Ledoux.
So I just want to follow up a little bit on some of the questions that Representative Reinbold asked to make sure that I understand. So there are two states, if I'm correct. It's Indiana and
what? Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, Connecticut.
Connecticut.
There's five states total that have enacted these, but I focused mostly on Connecticut and Indiana because Connecticut passed the law in 1999 and then Indiana in 2005. And so those have been in place long enough. I, tried to search to see if there was any evidence that the law was abused. Couldn't find that. Looked for lawsuits. Looked for the one that does exist but is different circumstances related to the warrantless seizure. So really wanted to focus on those because they've been in place long enough that you would have some ability to see how it was used or abused or what the effectiveness was.
Okay.
And I would just note, Representative Tarr forgot one. Florida passed one in the last 3 weeks.
Okay.
But that obviously hasn't been in place long enough to have any statistical research or anything else.
Does anybody have any statistics? And we can divide them into two categories of what the crime rate with guns, or the number of people who were injured or killed with guns prior to the passage of the law in those two states and after the passage of the law in those two states. And then another category is the number of suicides prior to the passage of the law and subsequent to the passage of the law. I mean, I'm kind of looking to see whether in either category we had substantial reductions.
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, we did make a one-pager where we had a comparison of the Alaska proposal prior to the committee substitute and then Indiana and Connecticut. And I'm hoping that that's in your packet, but we'll definitely get another sheet to you if not. And we pulled out some of this information because we thought it might be helpful about the retrieval of the guns and then the suicide. But that came from a more comprehensive report, and I would be happy to provide that report that goes through a discussion on all of those different points.
Okay, and actually, I think, is this what we're talking about right here?
Yes, this is what I'm referring to. So, for example, at the bottom row that says research on the success of the policy. So here for the Connecticut law, found for every 10 to 11 gun removal cases, one suicide was averted, an estimated 72 averted suicides. And then under the column for Indiana, the court retained firearms in 63% of the cases and dismissed 29% of them. Most individuals whose firearms were removed did not request return of their firearms.
That's an interesting statistic, but that actually doesn't show whether or not either crimes using guns, hurting other people with guns, or hurting yourself with guns, actually, whether it had any effect, at least for the Indiana.
Representative, could you just briefly describe the document for the record? Transcript isn't clear what the – if you could just describe that and Representative Ledoux can finish her follow-up.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Clayman, and to Representative Ledoux. We're looking at a document that compares the gun violence protective order statutes in Connecticut and Indiana to the proposal under consideration for Alaska in terms of who can file one, the length of time, whether there's language in there about mental health provisions, warrantless seizure, seizure of another person's guns, and then research on the success of the policy. And this was drafted because these are several of the items that came up as questions during the initial hearings. And you'll see that some of the language that's listed here has been incorporated into the new version of the bill so that there are protections in there. For example, under the Indiana law, you'll notice this language that says that an individual who has a mental illness it says instructions to determine whether the individual is defined as dangerous includes but is not limited to whether the individual, A, has a mental illness that may be controlled by medication and has not demonstrated a pattern of voluntarily and consistently taking the individual's medication. So, for example, that or the above language that talks about having previously been in a mental health facility. So neither of those can be used as things that establish someone's mental health in themselves. So, for example, those provisions have been added into the new committee substitute to put in some stronger language there. But on the bottom of the page, you'll notice the asterisk points to a report called Developments in Mental Health Law, the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. That's where we pulled the data from the research on the success of the policy, and it's a very lengthy report, and there's much more information in that.
So can we get a copy? Can we get a copy? Can your office provide us a copy of that article?
Yeah,
Follow-up,
so
Representative.
That goes to some of the points, but one-page proposal.
But one of the things that I think is missing from this, which is really, like, critical, is under Indiana, it doesn't show at all what the crime rate was with guns, the number of people who were injured or killed with guns before or after, the number of people who killed themselves before or after. I mean, as I say, it's an interesting statistic, but it really doesn't, I don't think at least, go to whether or not the statute is working. And as for...
I guess one of the questions that would raise Representative Ledoux would be what level of change would you think was worth a statutory change like this? Does it need to be cut the violence, let the gun violence in
half? Well, I'd actually like to see whether it cut the gun violence at all. And that's what's kind of missing.
Okay. Well,
here.
We can start with that article and see what other information is available.
And Mr.
Representative Tarr.
Lizzie said that this has been distributed to members. This development and mental health is part of the packet. So it's a lengthy one, but for example, on page 17, it says experience under temporary firearm removal statutes, and it goes through and it talks about Connecticut, and there's much more information. It talks about Indiana, the first 2 years, you know, how many cases they heard. It talks about patterns, and so there is more information. And just this particular document was prepared based on a lot of the questions that had come out in the initial hearings, so we can consolidate and provide additional information. That's no problem.
And so apparently this was just sent to all of us by email. It was too many pages to print out for everybody, but apparently it's in your email. And Representative Reinbold, you'd asked a question about fiscal notes, and apparently they were distributed some time ago, so they're already posted and online. And Representative, I've got you in the queue, but Representative, did you have more follow-up?
I guess I'm just interested in the determination as how they determined that for every 10 to 11 gun removal cases, one suicide was averted. So I guess I'm looking for that in 1998, for example, there were 50 suicides using guns, and in 2013, there were less than that, for example. Of course, you know, if the population has increased, et cetera, that would make a difference. And I guess I'd also like to see whether or not if there's a determination that there were less guns used in suicide, what that did for the suicide statistics overall, because if people were killing themselves with other things, then I question that. So I'm just kind of interested in that.
Any other questions?
Nope.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, well, this is a slippery slope, and I know it, but page 9, I did want to say it's...
Page 9 of the bill?
Yeah, page 9 of the committee substitute version R. And speaking of that, I don't know if we've seen fiscal notes for version R. I don't know if there's changes in the fiscal note, but it sure seemed like this bill is quite a bit different. I know we got fiscal notes a long time ago, about from 75, but it just seems like this one's quite a bit different.
I don't think it's the practice note for them to issue new fiscal notes when we get new versions, but go ahead.
Okay, so I really feel like one of the concerns that I believe it was Rep. Ledoux brought up was they didn't want it to be a deterrent for people to get help, mental health. And I feel like this bill is better in regards to that on page 9, because it says even, you know, the fact that an individual has been released from a mental health facility and has mental illness for which the individual has been prescribed medication does not determine that that individual is dangerous for purposes of, and then it gives the statute number. So I just felt like that was an important something to get on record and get into the bill. Where my concern comes is we possibly would want to also get possibly a psychiatrist or not, psychiatrist that actually prescribes medication. So just having an overview possibly of which drugs, because if you watch TV at all, you know, all these ads are on for pharmaceuticals, which I can't say that I support, you know, but I can say they're on there a lot. And it just says you might have thoughts of suicide or this or that. And it just seems like we want to make sure we know probably some of the most highly prescribed, more dangerous, you know, products out there. I think would probably not, whether it's appropriate here or physicians, maybe would even be better. But I just think that that's kind of something that needs to be on our radar.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Comments?
I see Representative Eastman. You and Representative Eastman.
I'll defer for the moment.
Actually, you're up next, Representative Eastman. Go ahead.
So through the chair, I'm curious about this this study, and just for the record, could
you mean that you mean the University of Virginia article?
Yeah, I was going about to explain that. About this study, for the record, could you tell us if these numbers of people saved from suicide or saved from gun violence also take into account individuals who became victims of crime after they lost access to firearms in their own defense?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, there's no evidence in the documents that I mentioned that.
Was that taken into account or not?
It's through the chair to Representative Eastman. It's not discussed in these documents.
Okay.
But I will say again that I spent quite a bit of time trying to find any information or evidence that these were abused in any way or had any negative outcomes, and I have yet to find any information on that.
Okay, thank you. And question for Ms. Mead.
Question, Ms. Mead, if you could come up.
Ms. Mead, through the chair, I'm curious from your experience and what you know, do you have a way of anticipating with what degree of frequency the courts might grant these gun violence protective orders that are requested under this new legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman.
Better tell us who you are, too.
This is Nancy Major.
It is after 7. We'll give you some flexibility.
I'm sorry about that. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I wouldn't be able to predict how many would come. I would be able to say with domestic violence protective orders, there are currently three types of orders, and one type can be filed by a law enforcement officer. The other is the short-term order filed by a household member, and then a long-term filed by a household member. The ones filed by law enforcement are not terribly common. They're much more common by household members, and when they are filed, they are looked at by a judicial officer carefully, just like everything else. They have a higher grant rate than those filed by household members, but they are denied sometimes, just like anything that comes before a judge, I guess I'd say, just like applications for search warrants are sometimes denied if the judicial officer determines there is not probable cause.
Thank you. And follow up through the chair.
Representative Eastman.
So other than search warrants, are there other types of things that law enforcement comes to the courts and, you know, makes requests of the court with some degree of regularity?
Through the chair, that might be actually a better question for somebody from law enforcement. I know law enforcement officers can file criminal complaints that the district attorney will then pursue in different areas. They can, certain types of law enforcement officers, peace officers, which include probation officers, can file petitions to revoke probation, and they do that on a regular basis. If that's helpful, I'm not sure, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And follow up through the chair.
Representative Eastman.
And so let's take search warrants, for example. Can you give us an idea of how often courts grant search warrants, which are, I'm assuming, usually applied for by law enforcement, as this bill would be?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I would have to look at data for that. I would not want to hazard a guess because it would be just a guess at this point, and I can get that if you're interested.
I would be. Thank you.
Okay.
I would note that one of the areas that police do periodically request search warrants is in DWI cases when they need to get a warrant to seize blood. I, again, can't tell you the frequency. Mm-hmm. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. I don't have a question for Ms. Mead.
Okay. No. You're next in my queue for comments or questions.
I appreciated the question earlier from Representative Reinbold about, and I want to be specific, assaults with firearms and suicides with firearms. If pre and post law. And I think it's great. And the uniform crime reports will tell us that. Every state has to submit. Every Department of Public Safety tracks that every year. It turns into the FBI's annual report on crime to the nation, and it's broken down by state. And we should be able to see if there has been any appreciable impact with this law. Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to see that we're using the standard of probable cause. It's the standard that law enforcement is used to working with in establishing whether or not a particular fact or circumstance exists or not. I like the fact that the bill says that a less restrictive alternative, you have to show the court that you actually tried a less restrictive alternative, was tried and it was ineffective on the long-term orders. I think that is good. It's on page 5, line 4, that is there. And I think, the court should ask, hey, did you try anything, that's less restrictive to, and why does it have to be this? That the witnesses are examined under oath. And I also liked something that we're doing differently here that Indiana did not do. Indiana required that the person whose firearm was taken from them petition the court to get it back. Under this, when the order expires, you get it back. You just get it back. If it's the ex parte order, you get it back after 20 days, unless the court dissolves it sooner. And if it's the long-term order, when it expires in 6 months, you get your gun back. And I think that's a good thing, because if the person truly is still dangerous, then we do want public safety to come back and say, Judge, we need a continuing order, and here's why, and they have to prove it all over again. But the default should be that someone gets their firearm back when an order expires, rather than have to go through the rigmarole of going through a petition again and hopefully getting your court date set. And so that is different than Indiana here, as we actually have an expiration which would allow that firearm to be returned to the person. And I think, Mr. Chairman, as we go through this, it will all get more clarity. I think Representative Reinbold has asked some good questions also about public safety testimony and about data points, and I think that hopefully we'll get some good answers.
All right, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is our representative from the Department of Law available?
Nope, not tonight.
Okay. Then maybe for the sponsor. So I would like to know, how is a dangerous individual treated under current law?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I could answer that if we could refine that just a little bit. I mean, that's a very overly broad question. Is the person in a domestic dispute? Are they in a public place? Are they threatening people? Do they have a weapon? There's so many factors that would influence how a dangerous person would be addressed. I guess it would be difficult for me to answer that without more specifics about the circumstances that you are wanting to ask about.
Okay. Follow up through the chair.
Representative Eastman.
So I guess this bill doesn't really require a whole lot of scenarios. It doesn't require someone to be even an immediately dangerous person. It just requires them to be a dangerous person. So if someone's a dangerous person, they come to the attention of law enforcement.
Representative Eastman, you're misrepresenting the definition of dangerous person that's in the bill. The statute specifically proposed is under subsection A1 of section 1865-845 as proposed would present an immediate risk of personal injury to self or others. So your suggestion that it's ambiguous is just not true, but you can go ahead and try your question again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And immediately the line after that, you see a big or, and suddenly someone doesn't have to be an immediate risk. Somehow they can just be a risk. And I'm talking about the A risk part of that requirement. And so if someone is A risk, a dangerous individual, and they come into contact with law enforcement under current law, how does law enforcement treat them under current law? I want to make a contrast so we know what we're getting to, what we're changing with this new bill.
Representative Eastman, I'm sorry. I think that's a question that you can address when we have some public safety officials here. I don't think that's really in the scope of what the bill sponsor should be asked to answer.
Okay. Follow up then through the chair.
Go ahead.
So I'd like to know, we have in the section we were just referring to, top of page 9, line 3, someone who has shown evidence to give rise to a reasonable belief that the individual has a propensity or propensity for unstable conduct. And I'm wanting to know from the sponsor, why did you choose the definition of unstable conduct? Why you use that those words, and what does it mean?
And Representative Eastman, that's best answered by, I'm best to answer that because I've been working on the committee substitute. The language that's used that you're looking at on page 9 at the top is actually patterned after the law in Indiana, and so the best source to understand that would be to read the case from Indiana that discusses it.
And so what is unstable conduct?
I'd urge you to read the Indiana case.
And why did we choose it?
As I said before, and I'll answer it one last time, this section of the bill is patterned after the Indiana law.
All right, so we don't have that in front of us. Is there, can somebody provide that to the committee so that we can?
We'll be happy to distribute it. Actually, it has been distributed to the committee, the Indiana law.
Yeah, I appreciate a copy. So is there a definition for unstable somewhere in statute?
Or nope.
So who's going to define that?
Representative Eastman, when you have part of the role of the statutes is not to define every single word of every single statute, or else you would have dictionaries, and that's what dictionaries are for. I think that the use of unstable conduct is something that it is defined as common knowledge and it has some common parlance within law enforcement, and I think that would be something the court would look at and consider the specific facts of the case. Representative Kopp may have some input on that as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say, I think that that whole section that Representative Eastman was referring to has to be read in context. It begins on page 8, line 27, there, section 2. So an individual is considered dangerous if the individual presents a risk of personal injury to self or others in the future. And so line 1 is the immediate risk. Line 2 is the risk to self or others in the future. And then it adds the qualifiers. It says you have the future risk and the individual has a mental illness for which the person has been prescribed medication, that the person has demonstrated a pattern of not voluntarily consisting taking while not under supervision, or is the subject of documented evidence that would give rise to a reasonable belief the individual has a propensity for violence or unstable conduct. You know, the qualifier of the two mental health, A and B, is predicated on line 2, which first you have to establish that they are a risk of personal injury to self or others in the future. I would say the difference between the immediate risk would be when someone makes the direct threat of self to harm or others, very specifically. The future risk is when they post online that I'm going to be a professional school shooter. Now you've got the future risk there, and then if you have one of these mental health things in it, in addition to that, that would give rise to the dangerous individual definition coming into play, because we also refer to mental health facilities and mental illness in this section. I think that probably one of our medical health professionals would be great to comment on it.
Follow up? Yes, so that brings up a great part of the bill to focus on. So a risk of personal injury to self or others in the future. The future seems pretty broad. Is there any case law that would pare that down? Are we talking 6 months, 3 months, 30 days?
Representative Eastman, there's obviously no case law interpreting this in Alaska because this would be a new statute and it hasn't been applied in Alaska before, and we're aware of one case in Indiana. I think these are the kinds of things that judges would apply their usual good judgment in determining the circumstances.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carr.
And just as we discuss these, I think there's just, rather than focusing on the descriptive language that Representative Eastman was looking at, I want to focus people back to the standard of evidence that has to be used. And I think that's really critical. It's sort of less, those current unstable conduct, those are commonly understood terms. But, you know, that in itself isn't, I think, where the real focus is. It's the high standard of evidence that has to be proved for probable cause or clear and convincing evidence that the judge has to use. So I think that's more where the energy is best spent thinking about that. I mean, that's the language that means that, you know, whatever the evidence being presented is, you better have solid evidence that about this behavior, and that the judge will have to use that very high standard in assessing the danger.
And follow-up.
Representative Eastman, I'll give you two more follow-ups, and then we're going on to somebody else.
So on page 8, lines 10 and 11, it spells out that you are not entitled to court-appointed counsel for defending yourself against this type of order. And I'm wondering, so I see that as kind of the warning label. What is it, where in the bill does it actually provide that you're not entitled to court-appointed counsel?
Representative Eastman, if you will recall the earlier discussion, we heard testimony from several people, including an opinion from the Attorney General, that in a civil proceeding such as this, just as in a domestic violence protection order proceeding, except in a very limited set of circumstances, there is not a right to court-appointed counsel. And so this simply requires that the court, the notice that is provided to a person in this specifically state, that they are not entitled to court-appointed counsel. And that's the only place where it says that.
And could we, through this bill, change that so that they were eligible for court-appointed counsel to defend themselves against this new law?
Representative Reinbold, I really apologize, Representative Reinbold. Representative Eastman, the prior testimony was that to add to the duties of the public defender agency would to provide counsel in these circumstances, which is not a criminal case and then it's not a child custody matter, would require a change to the public defender's statute, and that would bring with it a fiscal note.
Thank you. And one final question for now.
Representative Ryan Eastman, that was your last two. Representative Ledoux.
Okay, so I'm
buying you dinner.
Deal.
So I'm looking at page 8, section 1865, 845, 8 and 9. So, you've got a risk of personal injury to self or others in the future, and the individual has a mental illness which they're not taking their medicine for. And then it says, or is the subject of documented evidence that could give rise to a reasonable belief that the individual has a propensity for violence or unstable conduct. Shouldn't that be and rather than or?
David, do you mind turning?
You wouldn't really want to be.
You mean this is that you're talking about page 8 and 9?
Yeah.
Actually, at least in the drafting, obviously you can take a different perspective, but the I think in drafting and requesting the CS, there was specific interest in some individuals who actually may have a propensity for violence who are not qualified as mentally ill. That's one of the part of the testimony we heard, that some people may be quite stable and quite angry, and they may have a history while being angry of inflicting a lot of violence.
Okay, but what
so
I'm
that's the reason why it's
no,
or.
I get that. What I'm really more concerned about is the person who's got the mental illness for which they've been prescribed medication and they're not taking the medication. I mean, just because they're not taking the medication doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to do something violent. So, I mean, I'm seeing what you're talking about, that the person who has documented evidence that would give rise to a reasonable belief that the individual has a propensity for violence or unstable conduct. That makes sense in and of itself, but I'm not sure that just taken the guns away from somebody because they've been, the shrinks have said that they're supposed to take medication, and then they're not taking the medication. I mean, lots of people, I mean, that's kind of up in the air, and there's, you know, there's a lot of disagreement about some of these medications. So I just point that out.
And that's a good point, Representative Ledoux. I think you have to look read subsection A in the context of the overarching subparagraph 2, that it's not just are they off their meds, but that they're off their meds, and there's either a clear and convincing evidence or reasonable or probable cause that they're a risk of personal injury to themselves or others. So just being off their meds and talking wacky doesn't get you a gun violence protective order. You've actually got to have additional evidence that they are a risk to themselves or others in the future. So you've got to still get that dangerous factor included.
But just follow up here.
Representative Levin.
I mean, the futures, I mean, to me, that's kind of a nebulous concept. And while it makes perfect sense to me that you'd want to do something and do something like on an ex parte basis and so forth, if you've got somebody who's, I mean, flinging a gun around and saying crazy stuff and that they're going to blow everybody up, I mean, that's one thing. And it's kind of another thing. I mean, is the future, is that a week from now? Is it a year from now? I mean, I'm just throwing it out.
It's an interesting thing the one thing I would respond is that one of the reasons, because we heard from several people before preparing the CS, and you were one of them, that was concerned about the abuse of domestic violence protective orders, and that's why this is officers only can apply. And again, we will do our best to get some public safety officers available at the next hearing, but I think the reassurance you can have is that if you go to the police officer and you say, I think Joe is going to be dangerous in 6 months when such and such happens, I think the police officer is going to say, I've got a lot of more pressing needs on the docket right now, and I think that the requirement of having a public safety officer being the applicant and needing to convince a court makes it likely that there's, even though you don't need to have, I think it makes it unlikely that somebody's going to say, give me an order that will take for something that's a long way away. I think there's an expectation that there's some immediacy.
Well, Mr. Chair, because they're up to 6 months in length, I think, you know, that would be the window really that you would be thinking about, because it's going to expire at the end of the 6 months. So for purposes of evaluating what the future is, I think that's probably the time frame you'd be looking within, because
were a year from now,
right?
Then. Okay.
Yeah. And
good
I think,
point.
And just to sort of tease out how it's the two-way, so it's not the immediate risk, you know, then you're in number two, it's the risk in the future. So you've got one pathway that's the person who has the mental illness where they're not taking the medicine, and then the other, which is the unstable conduct. But I think, at least in the work that I've done, and certainly I'm no expert in this, but you know, the way we think this might work is that family members approach law enforcement about this, and they would be part of that conversation. And for the circumstances, you know, from the work that we've done on mental health issues, family members will often see a pattern. You know, someone's doing pretty good, then they have not taken their medication for some period of time. That's where the concern is. They're hoping to get them back stabilized on medication and into that routine. But I think those folks have a good understanding of the sort of the timeline of risk, if you will, because there's a pattern in that behavior of how quickly someone deteriorates when they're not medicated for one of their, you know, mental health conditions.
It's almost 8:30. I think we're starting to get down to some pretty narrow rabbit holes, and I'm going to, Representative Christ Tompkins has asked for a question, and we'll see if I'd like to stop at 8:30.
I really want to say something.
Representative Price Commons, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can pose this question to be taken up another time or offline, but fresh in my mind is whatever the bill was from Representative Guttenberg in which we went down the deepest, darkest rabbit hole of the definition of peace officer, and I see peace officer on page 2, line 18, and page 3, line 31. Obviously, it's a sort of important concept in this bill, and I'm wondering if there is a definition for peace officer that this bill is tethered to that makes it clear whether it's troopers and what we normally think of as police, or if it's potentially a broader question. Again, don't need a hard answer, but we just wanted to flag the question.
We'll get an answer. I know that's actually an issue we've been addressing in connection with House Bill 355, and so we can get that answer for you. Representative Eastman.
If I could just quickly, we spent some time on this very discussion about whether in some places where it said law enforcement versus peace officer, but peace officer is the generally used term in statute to describe local police, troopers, or VPSOs.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Representative Eastman, I'm going to give you one question. I'm going to give Representative Reinbold one question, then we're going to conclude.
Thank you. So a question to the sponsor or writer, whoever that was. So we've specifically spelled out in this bill that if it's for an ex parte order, that the information is not going to be available on court view to the public. But why did we leave open that an individual who's subject to a six-month gun violence protection order would have their information on public so that someone who may want to steal from their house could identify that they don't have any weapons?
Representative Eastman, it had nothing to do with the scenario about trying to identify houses. The interest was two parts. One, to be consistent with the domestic violence protective orders, which are available on court view. And we wanted to provide protections for those who are subject to an ex parte order, hence they don't have the opportunity to contest that proceeding. That wouldn't be available on court view. It's only when it's a contested proceeding, so they've had their opportunity for due process to contest the issue or proceed as they wish, that's the only information would go on court view. That's the reasons. Representative Reinbold.
Okay, so I think you're in a little bit of trouble for a couple different reasons, but one of them is the fact that I am having an issue with the dangerous individual definition as well. I really have a hard time, thinking that, medications are going to be the end-all be-all when a lot of medications have serious side effects and actually can cause violence or suicidal thoughts. So I'm going down the rabbit hole with Ledoux on this, so I think you're in a little bit of trouble with that. And on a second note, but I'm glad that it's defined, so don't get me wrong, I'm glad, but I really do think this is a slippery slope. But on a different note, the second reason you're in trouble is I'm going to ask Lizzie if she can get our nameplates on both sides, okay? Just to make sure you don't get confused. And I'm not sure if you're offering dinner to me or to him or to both of us or individually, but I am taking you up on it.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold. We will adjourn this meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 28 at 1 p.m. On Wednesday, we will hear Senate Bill 93, Credit Report Security Freeze, sponsored by Senator Coghill, and House Bill 367, Native Corporation Liability from Contamination, sponsored by Representative Millett. If anyone is considering an amendment to House Bill 75, the bill we've been hearing tonight, Gun Violence Protective Order, sponsored by Representative Tarr, please let my office know and submit them electronically no later than 4 p.m. on Wednesday. My goal is to take up amendments at our Wednesday evening meeting. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 8:32 p.m.